Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this marvelous network known as Blog Talk Radio. Have a fantastic guest tonight, senior writer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, David Klinger, will be joining us in just a few moments, and we're going to find some behind-the-scenes things about this fantastic service that manages our wildlife all across North America, and that'll be happening in just a few moments. Also, in just a little bit, a kind of a Super Bowl preview. We call him the greatest sports fan in North America, Mark Chesna, who is also with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and quite a Packers fan. He'll be giving us a little insight on the Super Bowl, some speculation, maybe give you an idea if you're wagering on the Super Bowl, which direction you might want to go. Handling the technical responsibilities, Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson. And as always, our musical director, Jim Johnson, from 91.1 FM. And, of course, handling the Wild World news from his massive studios in Indianapolis, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
Well, we're in a big ice cube right now.
Yes, we are. And you have one of the greatest sledding hills in the state. What's that like?
Well, too bad it's my driveway.
Yeah.
We've been on the hill for a couple of days. Now, I almost ventured down it today, but it's an ice skating rink. In fact, we were laughing because on the local television station, they showed a young man ice skating right down the streets of Indianapolis. And he said it wasn't a bad surface with all this freezing rain we've had. So, and
yeah,
plus massive.
That's how it is right now. And
yeah.
with all the public schools closed, you're not doing any animal shows.
No, sir. Nope. We've been off all week. So, we'll have to do quite a bit of making up like the children are going to have to do with these school days. They'll be going to school they're speculating maybe till July 4th. So they've got that to look forward to. Taking care of our Wild World news is Dr. Henry Day, and using artistic modern style, Jet Kaiser Films is the underwriter for the Wild World news with the Honorable Dr. Day. What do you have for us tonight?
Well, since we have special guests tonight, we're going to scamper through the news.
Okay.
Yesterday, Philadelphia celebrity Punk Satani Phil, the weather-predicting groundhog, did not see his shadow, which is good news for us because that foretells an early spring. And, gosh, I hope that little guy's right.
I hope he is, too. I'm praying on the groundhog.
All right. Sex and the City star Kristen Davis will receive the Weiler Award from the Humane Society of the United States for helping orphaned African elephants. The award is given to a celebrity or public figure who has brought positive attention to animals. She will receive the award at the Animal Protection Organization's 25th anniversary Genesis Awards, which will be held on March 19th in Los Angeles.
Well, good for her. That's outstanding.
It is outstanding.
Yes, it is.
All right, now, here's something we've been reporting about for the last year. I'll pick Vermont for this story, but this has been going all year. It's bad news for the bats. The Endangered Species Committee recommended that the little brown bats and the northern long-eared bats be added to the state's endangered species list because their populations have declined because of the white nose syndrome. Now, the population of the little brown bats has declined 75%.
Oh.
And some surveys even failed to find any of the northern long-eared bats. This is a big problem.
Big problem, yes.
They not only do they take care of mosquitoes, but they also pollinate.
Yes, they do. And I believe I'd read somewhere that one colony of bats will consume about 2,000 pounds of mosquitoes in a season. That's a lot of skeeters.
That's a lot of skeeters, and as small as those little things are, that's quite impressive.
Yeah.
All right, now here's something that's pretty common here in the States, and we don't really think too much about it, but it's big news in Hawaii, Honolulu. Agriculture inspectors and police captured a black rat snake more than 4 feet long on Oahu over the weekend. Department of Agriculture said in a statement, snakes are not native to Hawaii and have no natural predators, so they pose a big threat to the state's bird populations.
That's right. There's no snakes in Hawaii. You would not think so with the tropical weather, but yes, that could be a problem.
Well, that's it. We've got a couple good guests on tonight, so let's get going.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Day. Using an artistic modern style, Jet Kaiser Films produces affordable wedding videos that are as unique as the couples that star in them. Check out his website, JetKaiserFilms.com, and bringing the Wild World News, of course, Dr. Henry Day. Also underwriting tonight's program, Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones, taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. Their number is 317-243-0700. And also a big thank you to Peter and Kathy Weimer, and We Want You Cottages. Visit today their fantastic resort on the banks of Chautauqua Lake, and their addition to their website, iKids Fishing, promoting getting youngsters interested in the fantastic sports of fishing. Those are a few of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. We have a special guest tonight. Well, we have two special guests, but I'm thinking maybe 3 or 4 months ago, we had our good friend Mark Chesna on with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I've nicknamed him North America's greatest sports fan. So I thought we needed to have Mark come in for just a few moments here and give us his insight, his thoughts on the upcoming Super Bowl in Dallas. How are we doing, Mark?
Pretty good, Larry. How are you doing?
So are you going to the Super Bowl?
No, tickets are a little too expensive for me. I just looked online, and so far the lowest one's down at $2,100, which is about half of what they were last time I checked. So they are going down a little bit, but the problem being is Green Bay and Pittsburgh have got the most supportive fans in America. If you go to an away game for either of these two teams, and I've been to every NFL stadium except for three of the new ones, but there's Packer games. I grew up in Wisconsin, so I'm originally a Packer fan, so I follow them more. But I've been to games that have been more Packer fans than the home team in Seattle's old stadium and Tampa's old stadium and Phoenix. And I know that the same thing is true in Pittsburgh when Pittsburgh traveled, because the Steelers fans are good fans. So I think that's going to make fans a little out of my range. Unless any of your viewers out there, listeners out there, Larry, have got one they want to contribute, and I'll fly right down if that's the case.
Well, my listeners, you heard it. contact us through our Blog Talk site.
I'm not counting on it, but that would be, I'm just saying that's just, I went to the Packer playoff game in Atlanta, and I went to six or seven games during the year, NFL games, but I don't think I could ever, on a government wages, right, David, afford a Super Bowl ticket.
That's a little cash.
Yeah.
And, and I'm the worst because I think the best seat in the place is my couch in front of the television. So.
The way I look at that is, you can watch every game. I'm the opposite. I want to go to games live. I go to so many games live that I'm almost actually bored watching games on TV, with the exception of the NFL playoffs, the NCAA tournament, and Packer games. But otherwise, if the Cowboys Eagles are on a Monday Night Football, I usually don't I'll care who wins, but. Well, not really, because I hate both teams, but I'll watch House or something else, and then I'll flip and check the score once in a while. But I'm like, I guess going so many times, I like the ambience of the stadium and to soak up even though the traffic and some of that kind of just be a little bit of hassle, I'd still rather be there if I had a choice.
What's your thoughts on the Super Bowl? What do you think is the possibility of happening this Sunday?
Well, the biggest surprise I've got is that the fact that the Packers are favored. I just don't see any reason that they should be. And I hope the Packers win. Obviously, being from Wisconsin and a Packer fan all my life, that's the team I want to see. But it's just that Pittsburgh, the main thing that worries me is the Bears' defense. Just the second half of the game, the NFC Championship game, they just dominated the Packers' offense. I mean, they just wore them down. And what worries me is that Pittsburgh's defense is so much better than the Bears defense, Ted. I'm thinking if the Bears can do that, what can Pittsburgh do? And Pittsburgh's gotten off a defensive coordinator in Dick LeBeau, who's incredible, and so he's going to take what the Bears did and just improve on that. And the Packers as well. I mean, they got the number two defense in the league behind Pittsburgh with Dom Capers, who came 2 years ago and has turned that program around defensively. So, I mean, they could do the same thing to Pittsburgh. It's just that the other thing that bothers me for the Packers' sake is I think there's only three players on the team that have got Super Bowl experience, and one of them was on injured reserve, wasn't even playing, John Kuhn. And then you look at Pittsburgh, who, you know, Roethlisberger already won a couple, as well as Hines Ward. They've got probably 20-some players that have gone through the experience, not just of the game. Mike McCarthy says, well, it's just another game. Well, it's not just another game. It's the week that builds up. It's the hoopla. It's the press conferences. And I think they're more prepared, Pittsburgh is. Now, that theory would be thrown out the window if you looked at last year with New Orleans going and winning it. So I'm hoping it's wrong, but right now, if I was a betting man, especially with the Packers being favored, I'd put my money on Pittsburgh, but I'm hoping that I'm wrong on that because I really want the Packers. You'll beat a Packer fan. That's what I'm rooting for.
Well, I'm thinking that this might be one of the best Super Bowls that's been held in a long time.
Well, what's happened lately is the last, I'm not sure the exact numbers, but the first, I don't know, 20 or 25 Super Bowls, I think it was something like only three, I don't know exact numbers, but Larry, but it was something like only five or six of them were decided by a touchdown or less. Mm-hmm. But the last 10, 12 Super Bowls, it's been like almost every other one has been decided that way. So they've become closer, they've become more evenly matched rather than the routes that Dallas and San Francisco used to put on the teams like Buffalo. They have been more evenly matched. And the last time these two teams played was a game in Pittsburgh, just not this past season, but the season before, where it literally Roethlisberger threw a touchdown pass on the last play of the game to beat the Packers, something like 37-36, and it was like he threw for over 500 yards, which is only done 10 times in NFL history. So if they have that kind of offensive explosion, but again, going back to what I originally said, both those defenses have been so improved that I don't expect that to happen this time around.
So you've heard it here, folks. Mark Chesna's pick is Pittsburgh. If he was...
Oh, wait, let me back up a second there. If I got a fishing going record as picking somebody, I'm going to pick the Packers, because if I got anybody from Wisconsin listening, that's not going to go right. I'm just, if I had to honestly put, a whole bunch of money on it, I'd really be leery about it, but I'm going to have to go with the Packers anytime I can. So that's just to be on the safe side, because I am a Packer fan, and you don't want to bet against your own team.
That's right. Well,
yeah, so
we appreciate your insight tonight, Mark, and thank you for joining us, and maybe after the Super Bowl here in a little bit, we'll have you back on and find out all the adventures you had this year traveling to various NFL cities and seeing games.
Okay, Larry.
Hey, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for having me.
You betcha. Mark Chesna with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As I mentioned moments ago, North America's greatest sports fan. We want to remind everyone that our show is underwritten by Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina. Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes, 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline, fantastic fishing, amazing golf. Go to their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. That's God's country, everybody. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Tonight's guest, boy, what an honor, senior writer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's recently written several articles kind of behind the scenes of what goes on with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Some pretty fascinating stuff from his home in, I understand, fairly ice and snow-free Martinsburg, West Virginia. David Klinger. Good evening, David.
Hey, Larry. It's great to be with you tonight. And a real honor.
Well, no, it's an honor on our part because, man, I tell you, I was even reading your biography, and you've been in Time magazine and all this great stuff, and man, this is just outstanding.
I have to say though that I work with Mark Chesna, and I once stumped him on a piece of sports trivia.
Oh, you did.
Let me see if I can stump you.
Uh-oh. That wouldn't be hard.
Name one of the two oldest continually occurring sports events in the United States.
One of the two sporting events. One of them would have to be the Indianapolis 500, because they're getting ready to celebrate 100 years, I would think.
That's a good one, but it's not the oldest.
It's not.
Nope.
Hmm. Well, I don't know.
And I stumped Mr. Chesna on this, too, so I take this as a point of pride.
Uh-oh.
Give up?
I give up.
The Kentucky Derby?
Uh-oh.
And the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show?
I would have never thought the dog show.
And people say, well, they're not people, but they're definitely athletes.
Oh, yes, they are.
So I think they qualify. I was, I've not yet made it to the Derby, but I did get to Madison Square Garden for the Westminster show. It should, in fact, I think it comes up this month again. So it's an experience.
It's a spectacular event, the opportunity to see all these different breeds. And I'll tell you what, the people that handle these dogs, that's a whole different deal there.
Oh, it's another world.
Oh, it is. It is. The time and care that goes involved with these dogs. And what's really wild is who owns these dogs apparently have so much money that they don't show the dogs. They pay people to do that.
Oh, the handlers. Oh, yeah.
Right.
It's quite a profession.
Oh, my Lord. And I had a good friend who was in the dog showing business for a while, and she said I don't know what you compare it to, but she says it's kind of political. I mean, you have to do it for a long time, and these judges and so forth, you have to be in with it. She said it's pretty complicated, and I guess you would call it society work, so.
Larry, it's all who you know.
Absolutely. So,
well, speaking of species and breeds, it's my great fortune to have been working for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for, now I'm 34 years.
Oh.
And I've gotten to really be kind of a fly on the wall at some of our most interesting and newsworthy stories.
Mm-hmm.
I got to see the first condors reintroduced to the wild in Southern California, and then again when we established an experimental population over in Northern Arizona, and I got to be on the sea otter relocations on the California coast, and we fought the spotted owl wars in the Pacific Northwest, and I was even on top of the Interior Building in Washington when the first peregrine falcons were released back in the 1970s. But more and more, I'm finding that the real exotic creatures in this agency are not the animals, but the people. And that's what I get to occupy my time with, some of my spare time, is digging out the stories of the interesting people who work for this agency and whose stories may not get told, but I get to tell them, so that's my great pleasure.
Well, God bless you, because I'll tell you what, we've had several folks on with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and every one of them has a story to tell, and they're fascinating.
Well, and it's an agency of good people. I think a lot of employees of this agency would pay the government to be able to work for this agency and to do the kind of work they do. The refuge managers around the country are doing fantastic work and at very low pay, and yet I don't think there's a one of them that if they had their choice, they'd pay the government to do what they do. They're that dedicated.
Well, that's true, and it's so amazing each year when we have a chance to see the National Conservation Training Center and the effort and the enthusiasm with the people that take care of that place and manage it and whatever. It's just always inspiring.
Now, Larry, did you know that we actually had about a dozen or two of our employees, our refuge managers, our hatchery managers, marked for assassination back in the 1970s?
Well, I wanted to get to that story. Please tell us, because I found this completely fascinating.
Does the name Squeaky Frome ring a bell?
Well, she does. That was kind of in my era. She was part of the Charles Manson family.
For anyone who's those younger than you and me, Larry, who doesn't remember what a horrible story it was. You know, the Manson family and the killings that occurred in Los Angeles in the late 70s, and the group associated with Charles Manson. There was one member of that group, Lynette Squeaky Frome, who was later arrested, but she attempted an assassination of President Gerald Ford back in 1975 in Sacramento, fired a gun or raised a pistol, aimed a pistol at President Ford, and she was taken into custody, was a former member of the Manson family. Our hatchery and refuge managers out west got visits a few months later, a few weeks later, by men in dark suits with narrow black ties. They were FBI agents. They had discovered that a number of our personnel, our employees, were on an assassination hit list discovered in her apartment. And they were simply going around notifying people and warning them that their names had been identified on this hit list. It was a very scary time back in the late 70s in Southern California, and so we took this very seriously. The story never really came out until I told it, because it was an in-house story in this agency. People were, it was kind of a mark of prestige to be able to say you were on Squeaky Frome's hit list.
I'm sorry, David. I swallowed. Coffee went down the wrong way.
Well, I'll keep talking then.
Keep talking. I'm here.
I'll just say that, and by the way, she's recently been released from prison, so I don't know she's at. But this is a story that's gone down in our agency as kind of an urban legend, but it's got a very serious element of truth to it, and shook some people up in that era. But 30 years later, we're able to tell the story. I'm looking at the FBI report right now.
What was their theory why they decided that these people were targets for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service?
Yeah, you've got to ask yourself that question. Why would a fish hatchery manager in Washington State have his name on the hit list for a hippie cult in Southern California? The theory is that they got lists of federal employees and prominent figures. Their goal was to ferment a race war, actually to assassinate people and to blame it on African Americans, and in that way cause a race war in California, which would lead to, you know, the overthrow of society. Kind of a stretch. There's an interesting and just very graphic book called Helter Skelter by Vincent Bugliosi, who I think it was a bestseller in the 1980s, that goes into all of this. But very scary times. I'm sure our refuge managers look back. They're okay with it now, but at the time they were very nervous.
I was going to ask you what their response was to that, whether they thought it was just a hoax or.
Well, no, it was. They treated it seriously, but you go on, you keep doing your job, and I had one hatchery manager tell me that he kind of shrugged and went on about his business, but his wife did ask him if his life insurance policy was paid up.
Oh, really? Now, that's true love there, I'll tell you right now.
Yeah. So, but that's one of the more graphic stories that I've unearthed. Gosh, what can I tell you about this agency, Larry?
Well, One of the things I found fascinating, now that I've got my voice back again, was the gentleman, and I've got it here in front of me, Walter J. Freeman. Dr. Walter J. Freeman.
Interesting man.
Yes, he is.
you know, a lot of people...
Go ahead.
A lot of people don't know that our parent agency, the Department of the Interior, since its inception back in 1849, it's been known as the Department of Everything Else, because if you had an agency or a function in government that you didn't know where to put it, you stuck it over in the Interior Department. So this department that we work for through history has really had a laundry list of functions that have really very little to do with wildlife or parks or the public lands, the resources that the Geological Survey and the Bureau of Mines and other agencies worry about, Indian Affairs. Those are the traditional functions of the Interior Department, but in the past, this agency, this department, it oversaw the pensions for Civil War veterans.
Mm-hmm.
There was a plan afoot to colonize Haiti with freed Haitian slaves. They ran the institution for the hard of hearing and the blind in the District of Columbia. They ran the streetcar system in Washington. I mean, just
odd
functions that today seem kind of a surprise, but back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, were important functions of the Interior Department. One of the functions was running the mental institution in the District of Columbia. It is known as St. Elizabeth's. It's since largely closed, but in that era, in the early 1920s, a gentleman named Dr. Walter Freeman started to work for that institution. He was an employee of the Interior Department for a few years. He went on to later fame as the father of American lobotomy, and that was a technique to deal with mental illness at the time. They did not have the drug therapies that we have today, and a rather horrific and largely unproven technique that was in great use in the 20s, 30s, 40s, up until, gosh, the 1960s. He got his start with our department, went on to become what one author said was the most scorned physician of the 20th century because of the how out of favor lobotomy fell, and then in looking at the way the technique was used, it was unproven, unscientific, and poorly administered, and a lot of people were hurt. And that's another aspect that of our history that, you know, may not be the happiest, but it's history, and I think it's important to tell these stories. There was an interesting documentary on PBS in the past couple of years called The Lobotomist, if anyone is interested in seeing a documentary on this subject, and what kind of a dark turn that medicine took in that era, and that we look back and shudder. But he was the doctor that performed a lobotomy on Rosemary Kennedy, the daughter of Joe Kennedy.
He did.
In the 1930s.
Whoa. Well, yeah, that's very dark medicine. Hopefully nothing like that ever.
Well, fortunately, we're a lot more enlightened about treatment of mental illness in this era. We no longer have the institutionalization of mass quantities of patients in these big institutions, and I think we've made a lot of progress. And of course, pharmaceuticals and drug therapies have sort of pretty much eliminated the need for lobotomy.
Well, that's a good thing.
Let's talk about something happy.
We will talk about something happy. We do have to take a quick break here, though. We're with Dr. David Klinger with the U.S. or excuse me, writer Dr. David Klinger with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We want to tell everyone that our program is underwritten by Harrison College, now offering veterinarian technician courses. If you love animals and people, this might be a great career path. Their website, www.harrison.edu. Or for more information, 888-544-4422. And also radiomom.fm, and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And listen to my show, The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, each Sunday at radiomom.fm. We'll be back with senior writer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, David Klinger. You're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Gosh, Johnny, playing in the cave sure is neat.
Oh, boy, a kitty cat.
Sassy, the kitty cat's yelling. What, Sassy? It's not a kitty? It's a bobcat? Speaking of cats, you like to stress the importance of adopting cats from animal shelters? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year? And with millions of healthy cats to choose from, it's a shame more people don't adopt from shelters?
This bobcat's heavy. Help, Sassy!
Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
What's that supposed to mean? Oh, nuts.
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt.
Here's a hot topic about our wildlands and living with the natural role of fire.
Yard work is not just a matter of pride when you live in the wildland-urban interface. It's also about survival. Here are some FireWise tips that can help protect your home from wildland fire. Prune your trees 6 to 10 feet above the ground. Remove dead leaves and branches and dispose of them before fire season. Water your lawn regularly and store firewood away from the house. Be prepared for a fire emergency by having a plan for your family and pets. Learn more at our website and then sit back and enjoy. You worked for it.
This hot topic was made possible by the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation. Learn more about the natural role of fire, how to protect your community, and get the latest fire information. Visit the National Interagency Fire Center website at NIFC.gov. That's NIFC.gov.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Hope everyone is having a great evening. Fantastic guest tonight, David Klinger, senior writer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We've been talking about some of the fascinating stories that he's written behind the scenes at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we'll be back in just a moment with David. We want to remind everyone that tonight's program is also underwritten by Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes, 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline, fantastic fishing and amazing golf. Go to their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org. At the start of our program, we were talking to David. He mentioned that he was involved with the release of the California condor, reintroducing them into the wild. Boy, what a story that is, David.
An incredible story, an incredible success story for the Endangered Species Act. And you know, a lot of people questioned the wisdom of taking the last remaining condors in from the wild in order to save the species. And we were sued, and we lost a lot of friends over that action. But in the long run, I think it's proven that that it was the wise thing to do, to bring the remaining condors, which I think were about 13, into captivity, to place them in breeding institutions in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles Zoo and the San Diego Wild Animal Park, and to captive rear young, awaiting the day that we could return them to the wild in more favorable habitat, in more stable conditions, and hopefully give the species that added margin of success, as it was really poised on the brink of extinction.
That had to be a scary proposition for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, realizing the responsibility. I mean, you're taking the last few ones out of the wild, and you're going to try and breed and raise these in captivity. That had to be quite a responsibility, not only for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but for the San Diego Wildlife Park and the Los Angeles Zoo.
Well, the margin of error was pretty thin. Obviously, if you've got a species under your care that no longer exists in the wild, you want to be pretty careful in how you handle it, how you conduct your management of it, and the caliber of the plan you have for returning it to the wild. But fortunately, this was in the early 1990s when the first reintroduction was done in the Los Padres National Forest north of Los Angeles. We've since added a experimental population in what's called the Arizona Strip. That's the portion of Arizona north of the Colorado River along the Utah border. You never want to have all your eggs in one basket, so to speak.
Right.
And so the notion was habitat for the California condor in California is very limited because of development and because of just the general pattern of how habitat degradation has occurred in Southern California. So it was our goal to try and get another population going in historic condor range. Mm-hmm. Condors were found even in the eastern United States through history. But that Arizona population and then another population was established up in the Big Sur area of Northern California. And when I last checked, they're doing pretty well. We still have problems with lead contamination in condors. That
yes.
still is a limiting factor for their survival, as well as strikes, bird strikes with objects or transmission lines. There's a lot of obstacles out there in the wild, and just the general limited habitat in certain portions of its range. But it is a success story. It is one we've, in a fairly short amount of time, showed that we could do it. But we couldn't have done it without those partners in the zoos. They were the real heroes of this story.
Well, it's a fantastic story, and we're so thrilled about the success of it. I would think probably one of the more, heated debates in what you've been involved with may have been the spotted owl in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. Where do I begin on that one? That was that's still going on. It is an issue that I think will be with us for a generation or more. I came in on it at the beginning when the species was first listed as a threatened species, and it really did ignite the Pacific Northwest in terms of it becoming a polarized and polarizing political issue.
Mm-hmm.
The fact, though, that the cut, the amount of timber cutting that was going on at the time was really, most experts acknowledge, was not sustainable. And a lot of that was being exported to foreign countries. And in a sense, the spotted owl was telling us that something's wrong out there in the forest. And as an indicator species, that's how we learn things. The species, in this case, the northern spotted owl, was indicating that the quality of habitat was declining, the amount of cutting was fragmenting the habitat into smaller and smaller patches where the species could no longer reproduce and breed and survive. It was never on the verge of extinction. It is a listed threatened species, which is a little less dire, but it did provoke significant changes in the way timber harvesting is done in the Pacific Northwest. And it's a battle that's still going on, and the final chapter on the northern spotted owl has not been written yet.
Well, it's in its own special way, it's saving a lot of trees.
Well, there are a lot of trees in Oregon and Washington, Idaho and British Columbia and Northern California, but it's the way we're managing them. That's, I think, and books have been written on this, that the clear cutting, the amount of fragmentation that's going on is just creating, what's left is just insufficient for species to connect.
Uh-huh.
For species to breed and for species to continue to populate. And so it's not just timber cutting, but it's the way the management was being done caused some real adjustments. And I think there's some very interesting things going on with new methods of sustainable forestry that maybe the spotted owl had a little hand in provoking those kind of changes.
Well, as you said, the story goes on, and I hope the last chapter of it is written by David Klinger.
Well, I don't know if I'll be around for that, but it was a fun story to work on. I was public affairs director, press officer for our agency in Portland for 10 years at the time, but it was for our people in the Fish and Wildlife Service, it was a very tough time. We've had threats. We routinely would not go out to certain areas in uniform or in government cars, and the political atmosphere was very supercharged. But it was good experience, and hopefully, I think really it's going to be up to the historians to write this story, and looking back 50 to 100 years from now in terms of how this story plays itself out. It's still very much a work in progress, but it was a real test for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I've got a question for you,
okay,
Larry.
Yes.
Tell me, talking of interesting stories, I don't know, you've probably been pretty focused on the weather out there in Indiana this week, but
right.
like me, you've probably been riveted about what's going on over in Egypt.
Oh yes,
watching the scenes there on television is just an incredible story that's going on there. Tell me can you name the location of the newest find in Egyptian archaeology, the newest city that's been uncovered, the most recent city that's been uncovered?
Well, I can't remember.
Where would that be?
Well, I'm thinking it wasn't in Egypt.
Correct.
But I'm trying to think. You know, I watched, did you remember when the Discovery Channel was running the program Chasing Mummies?
Yes.
With Dr. Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had talked about that. Fill me in, because it's escaped my.
Well, would you believe it's in California?
California,
an Egyptian city, California again, the left coast. We have the remnants of an Egyptian city underneath one of our national wildlife refuges in Central California.
Wow.
Can you believe that?
Now, what's the theories on this?
Well, back in the 1920s, a very enterprising young man who was making a name for himself in Hollywood named Cecil B. DeMille was looking for a location to shoot the silent movie version of the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you've seen that one. Most people think of the one that was done in the 1950s with Charlton Heston.
Right.
Well, this was done in 1923, a silent movie that it's a wonderful movie if and you can still find it on Netflix. Cecil B. DeMille took his film crew up to the Central California coast, an area known as Guadalupe Nipomo Dunes. This is a huge sand dune system in Central California. It's north of Santa Barbara and south of San Luis Obispo. Gorgeous area overlooking the ocean, but it looks very much like the Middle East, just miles and miles of sand dunes, and that's where they shot the silent version of the Ten Commandments. And he spent so much money building the Egyptian set for this movie that he went broke. And I mean, it was massive. He had 3,500 actors. This is in the 1920s.
Wow.
And they literally camped out there for months shooting this movie. And he built an entire city, the Egyptian city of Seti, and populated it with 21 sphinxes and 35-foot tall statues of Ramses. I mean, it is just gorgeous in the film.
Uh-huh.
Well, they spent so much money on it that they were in bankruptcy by the time the movie was done. And in those days, there wasn't any such thing as environmental impact statements. You just, you know, once you were done, you just struck the set. And in this case, they just dumped it and let the sand dunes cover it. And that Egyptian movie set was covered by this large sand dune system until someone discovered it recently.
Oh.
It's they uncovered some of the sets, some costumes. They even found Ramses' big toe, and there is a wonderful little museum in the town of Guadalupe that is preserving these artifacts from the area where we now manage it as a National Wildlife Refuge. But an incredible story that the uncovering of this lost Egyptian city on the California coast.
That had to be, for the person that discovered that, they're thinking, what in the world is going on here?
Well, urban archaeologists went to the site. They knew it had been filmed there. I'm not sure they knew that so much of the remnants were left behind. And in 1983, they pinpointed the site and started digging and came up with they found a horse's head and some bottles and fragments of wood, and then they pulled out a big plaster toe, which was presumably Ramses, and just more and more stuff came out of this. So, you know, managing a wildlife refuge is not always about managing wildlife and plants. Sometimes it's managing cultural artifacts, too. We have a very active archaeology program.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I've been in the archives at the National Conservation Training Center. That tells us right there that the broad spectrum that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service covers is absolutely amazing.
I think our name is somewhat limiting because we're not just fish and wildlife. We have law enforcement responsibilities. We do international work. Of course, people know about the Endangered Species Act, but a lot of our wildlife refuges have cultural significance. When I worked in the Pacific Northwest, we worked with some archaeologists who had uncovered an Indian city on Ridgefield National Wildlife Refuge north of Vancouver, Washington. And they found it by going back to Meriwether Lewis's journals. Lewis and Clark visited this Indian town. It was about 900 people, as I recall, of an Indian tribe right there above Portland, Klamath Indians. Not Klamath, but one of the Chinook tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the Columbia River had shifted its banks and, you know, there had been a lot of erosion in 200 years, when they found the remnants of this city, it was very close to where Meriwether Lewis said it was. The Indians in that, Native Americans in that area lived in plank houses made of cedar planks. And the city was estimated to be somewhere around 900 to 1,000 people. So it was a good-sized village. And you can still see the areas where the foundations of these buildings were put up and the marks left in the soil of the cedar planks that were a part of this village. So we were really living the history right along with Lewis and Clark's journals.
Wow, that's spectacular. That's just one of the articles that you had written that when I received them that I found is the unraveling of the mystery of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Well, everyone knows the tune that Gordon Lightfoot sang back in, mm-hmm. in our era, the 1970s, I guess, popular tune. It's still played. And the incredible story of that ore ship that went down in November 1975. It was loaded with iron ore, and probably one of the worst storms to ever hit the Great Lakes up until that point sent this mammoth ship to the bottom. It was headed from I believe Minnesota to Ohio, and it sunk just outside Whitefish Point, Michigan. And we were instrumental in the location of that, the wreckage of that ship. We have a research vessel that operates in the Great Lakes called the Grayling. It's a fisheries research vessel, which we loaned to the, well, it was a team of Army Corps of Engineers, National Geographic Society, and National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Everyone was attempting to locate the remains of this giant ore ship and solve the mystery of what happened. You've probably seen stories on cable TV about the mystery of the Edmund Fitzgerald, and we played a small part, at least, in helping to locate it through the use of our vessels that are operating on the Great Lakes. We have our own little Navy that operates in the Great Lakes doing research on sea lampreys and lake trout and mm-hmm. and invasive species that are becoming a greater and greater problem in the Great Lakes and some of the tributaries. We have our own Air Force in the Fish and Wildlife Service. We have a team of pilots that fly the waterfowl flyways from the United States up into Canada doing waterfowl survey work every year, and we've been doing that for many, many years, back to the late 1940s. So, again, this is an agency that has a lot of aspects to it that just aren't apparent on the surface, and I get to kind of dig some of these stories out. We had a gentleman that, fisheries researcher, Dr. Jim Warren, who I knew when I was out in the Pacific Northwest, he got to handle one of the most precious substances known to man. And what would that be, Larry?
Well, I'm going to show my stupidity again. I know it's not gold. I don't have a clue. Gosh, I feel stupid talking to you tonight.
What happened in 1969 that everybody around the world was watching on television? And we were all riveted to the summer of 69. What happened?
Was he handled a moon rock?
Yes, yes.
Ding, ding, ding.
the first moon rocks that were brought back to Earth, the scientists really were pretty nervous about, you know, what are these soil samples and rocks going to bring with them? Is there any, are there any contaminants or other life forms that could be a part of these samples that, if they were released into the Earth's atmosphere, could cause problems? So one of our fisheries researchers was detailed down to Houston to spend, I think, about a year on detail, actually doing taking minute amounts of these precious moon rocks and testing them on fish and other aquatic life to see what effect they had on them. And the great scientific discovery was not a damn thing. The fish did fine. And so there really wasn't the potential for contamination. They did not show any significant impacts on test animals. But we didn't know that at the time. So there were great precautions taken to handle those materials and to keep them in isolation before they were released. You'll see moon rocks now in the Smithsonian and in other institutions. But that first period when the Apollo mission returned to Earth, we didn't know that. So they turned to the Fish and Wildlife Service, among other federal agencies, and said, send people down here, help us test this stuff and figure out what it all means.
Did they decide what or what material they're basically the moon is made up of?
Yes, but I'm not a geologist, so I'm not.
Okay.
I'm not sure I know. It was. Oh my goodness! Yes, they did a thorough analysis, of course, chemical analysis, and but I don't. I'll have to look that up.
I have a good friend who was involved with the school kids being involved with NASA, and I'm almost certain that the moon rocks kind of went on tour for a while to various schools all across the country.
Yes, I think they did, but that was after all these tests had been
right.
done. They released them. I've seen them in the Smithsonian, and... And do you remember the fascination? Do you recall the fascination that the public was just mesmerized by the first moon rocks? Incredible.
Absolutely, and of course they were so concerned on what the material was made up, and as you said, could it be toxic to our environment in some way? And just like when we first stepped on the moon, and I still remember just like it was yesterday.
Well, Jim Warren told me, he says, to the scientists, they're really, in the back of their mind, there really never was a serious question about whether this stuff could really be contaminated because the moon is so bombarded with radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't have the atmosphere that the Earth does, that they were reasonably certain, even beginning their sampling, that there was not going to be a serious problem. But you can't take that risk.
No, you can't. Well, our guest tonight's been David Klinger. Gosh, David, our hour just flew by.
It did. I have about six more stories I'd love to tell you about. Can we go for another hour?
Well, I tell you what I'd like to do is have you back on here real soon. If you can.
That would be an honor.
Oh, no, it's an honor on our part. Gosh, what a fantastic show. I have so many more questions to ask you, and I know, like you said, you have several more stories to tell our listening audience from around the world. So this has been quite a thrill tonight, and God bless the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Well, thank you for your support, Larry. You're a good friend to this agency, and you're a good friend to wildlife. And it'd be an honor to come back and chat with you some more.
Well, that's honor's all ours, believe me. We want to tell everybody that tonight's guest has been David Klinger with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You can go to the Blog Talk Radio site, our site, Larry Batson's Wild World, and download this program free of charge or other programs from the past to listen to at your convenience. We also want to tell everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand-new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos, information about our animal family. I would like to thank Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson for taking care of the technical portions of our program, and, of course, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day, manning the Wild World News Booth. And our guest next week, David, happens to be our good friend Jay Slack and Stephen Chase, and we're going to talk about the recent Arctic Refuge Conference that went on at the National Conservation Training Center. So,
well, Jay is my boss, so say some good words about me.
I absolutely will. We love Jay Slack. He's one of the nicest guys I've ever met.
Terrific guy, and we enjoy having him here as director of the National Conservation Training Center.
Yes, it's absolutely fantastic. Thank you to all of our listeners. This is Larry Batson, and you've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.